Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.
Today's program is brought to you by the International Culinary Center, offering courses that range from classic French techniques in culinary, pastry, and bread baking to Italian studies to management, from culinary technology to food writing, from cake making to wine tasting. For more information, visit culinarycenter.com.
I'm Erica White, host of Let's Get Real, the cooking show about finding, preparing, and eating food. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Welcome to We Dig Plants on Heritage Radio Network. We are Groundworks, Inc. I'm Alice Marcus Krieg.
And I'm Carmen DeVito.
And we design, install, and maintain gardens in and around New York City. In our aim to bring the culture to horticulture, today we're embarking upon a new series, for the next couple of weeks called Heritage and Horticulture. It's topics that specifically relate horticulture and the United States, our founding, our economics, and our culture. So this will be a four-part series for now, and we hope to expand it into future projects.
Yes, and there's going to be some really interesting topics. Today's topic is going to be about the first ever commercial nursery in the United States, Prince's Nursery from Flushing, Queens. And then the second part of the series, the next show will be our President's Day show, and we're going to have a discussion about our founding fathers, their favorite plants, a little bit about their gardens, because the founding gardeners were really into plants and gardens and farming. And then we're going to come back to New York and kind of pre-New York, look at New Amsterdam with author Russell Shorto and his award-winning book, The Island in the Center of the World. And then finally, our personal favorite will be about the plants that came back from the Lewis and Clark expedition. So in this election year,
right,
we are going to be Americans, all of us, and talk about what matters.
We the plant people.
We the plant people, right.
So we thought we'd start right here in New York City with the first commercial nursery in the United States. It's called Prince's Nursery, and it was in Flushing, Queens. Sadly, it is no longer in existence, but the property has evolved into what is now the Queens Botanical Garden, and we have two representatives from the QBG with us today. Welcome Susan Lassert and Chuck Wade. Susan is the current executive director, and Chuck Wade is the former executive director of the garden, and they're going to be here to talk about Prince's history and how it evolved into the current Botanic Garden. It's a very interesting story. So when we first learned that the commercial plant nursery was located in New York, I became so excited and hooked on the idea of early horticultural history, because I strangely think, I often wonder daily about what life was actually like in Dutch New Netherland and in the early colonies. I often think about the dailiness of life, what people ate and what they drank and how they worked and how they slept and how they stayed warm. And if and when they went to school, how did they get to school and how they engaged in the community and how they walked through the streets. And the more I learn about New York City as an epicenter of early horticulture, the more fascinated I become. So that's what this series is going to kind of spawn from. New York.
Yes,
New York
and
history.
Living in New York all these years and walking those same cobblestone streets every day.
You can't ignore it.
You can't ignore it. I mean, Alice and I, sometimes you turn a corner and you see, oh, there's a plaque that said something from 1720 or 1620. And
right.
you can't help but think about it. If you pause for a minute and you stand there, or you go down to the Battery,
uh-huh.
right? And you think about, you know, that there were people, that there were Dutchmen 400 years ago standing there,
right.
and farming and bowling,
right.
and, you know,
right.
it's just
drinking.
Yeah, and drinking. You can't escape it. So it's a wonderful connection between horticulture and New York and American history.
Right. And I think most of us understand that Queens and Brooklyn were farming communities in the early 1700s. So they really revolved around the city. It was, you know, it's a natural extension, of course. And to think of a commercial nursery in these communities selling plants for working gardens and for medicinal purposes is another layer of fascination. So I'm going to put a little timetable and a setting in place. So Brooklyn and Queens, comprised mostly of German, Flemish, French, and English heritage, French Huguenots, they were subsistence farmers. It's the time frame of the Dutch West India Company. Ben Franklin was born in 1706. Tea was introduced into the United States in 1714. Ben Franklin established libraries in 1730. In 1732, George Washington was born. In 1718, the French established New Orleans, and the first slaves were brought to the United States in 1725. So exploration and trading are the driving force behind this, right? And that means plants, because what were they hunting for, and where were fortunes
made.
To be made? So, you know, there's European wars going on, war between France, England, and Spain. You know, there's a lot of cultural, religious wars going on. And, you know, it's just an amazing time in history. And meanwhile, there's this commercial nursery in the middle of this farmland in Queens. So that's what we're going to talk about. Prince's Nursery. It was established in 1737 by Robert Prince. And the first catalog of trees and woody plants came out in 1771. And this is a catalog of plants that is happening as the Boston Massacre is happening. So just to put a timetable on it, it's an amazing setting. So here's the first commercial and mail order nursery on U.S. soil. The selling of plants and trees and fruits. The business closes around 1865, which is right after the Civil War, when the son, William Robert, moves the retail business into the medicinal botany industry. So let's talk a little bit about Prince's Nursery. Chuck.
Yes.
Tell us a little bit about Prince's Nursery from your perspective as the former executive of Queens Botanic Garden.
Well, Prince's Nursery was, first of all, went along what we call Northern Boulevard today,
uh-huh.
and it went down to Flushing Landing.
Uh-huh.
Now, Flushing Landing was the place for ships and barges to come in from Manhattan, and they came about 8 to 10 times a day,
uh-huh.
bringing things into Flushing for the Prince family,
right.
because they put out a notice to all ship captains that they would like to get any seeds, plants, scions, and other plant material from around the world from those ship captains that were coming in from all over the world into Manhattan.
Right.
And so they put their notice out, and they said, if you mark your shipment or your bundle, Prince, uh-huh. Flushing Landing, we will receive it.
So,
and so they came.
It's yeah. so amazing to think that here's this, you know, this is really an entrepreneur, right?
Very,
Mr. Prince.
I think he's very ahead of his time, actually, don't you think?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
yeah.
He's
yeah.
very, very cutting edge. While most people were very much subsistence farming, he's like, I can sell.
Right. How are they going to get the plant material
that they want?
That they need, you know? So this wasn't gardening as far as like foundation plants for your house. This was real necessity. So it was material, right, Chuck, that was going back and forth from America to England and from England into the United States.
Yes.
Right.
You know, Flushing was actually more of an English town than the New Amsterdam. It was sort of of the line. Peter Stuyvesant put his influence over into Flushing, and the Bowne family, B-O-W-N-E, they were very, very well known as Quakers in Flushing. And so, therefore, their house, 1661, is still in existence. And so they were right in the middle of all this farming that was going on.
So tell me, what happened to the Mr. Prince's house, right? Let's talk a little bit about some New York history and what happened to the house and the original orchard and house and farmland.
Well, his house was still in Flushing up to the time of the New York World's Fair in 1939. And it stayed there at the foot of Flushing Landing. It was actually at the beginning of the Prince Nursery, which was later called the Linnaean Botanic Garden, by the way. But the Prince Nursery family lived in this homestead. They had in the lobby of their home a bust of Linnaeus because they honored him greatly, the great Swedish botanist. And they abided by the nomenclature that he established for organizing the plant world. And so they even listed their plants in their catalog under his name. Now, the house should have been a national shrine, as we know. The garden clubs of Flushing and other eminent groups said to Mr. Robert Moses, "Please, Mr. Moses, let us retain this house. Let us preserve it," because it was going to be demolished because the Flushing Bridge was being built over toward Manhattan, across over the Flushing River, where we have now House City Corps Stadium. But they wanted to get this house saved, and they even had a proposal to put it on land at Flushing Meadow Corona Park.
And just so our listeners know, Moses was the urban planner extraordinaire, who really
let's use that word,
who really kind of designed the New York that we know today, and he built the highways and
beaches.
There's a lot of the beaches. There's a lot of controversy about him, but he really laid out the roadways as they currently are. So in doing so, he bulldozed this house, and it's gone.
Off with their heads.
Unfortunately.
Because we have, I have no time for this, but it's a shame, really. I wish it could have been moved over and boarded up, if nothing more, and then saved later.
So the Prince's Nursery, Susan, tell us a little bit about some of the early plants we've been talking.
Well, Prince Nursery was in existence when the United States wasn't in existence. I think that's really significant, 1737. And the Prince Nursery was known as the source for so many things. There were, Chuck and I were talking in the car on the way over, how many different kinds of apples they have. How many is that, Chuck?
450 varieties.
Of apples. Because when we were doing our master plan for the garden, one of the botanists working with us really was so charmed. And he said that, you know, there are apples that are good for canning, apples that are good for stewing, apples that are good for eating. And so the Prince family, they really knew all of this. And they were the source for so much, for so many people. And when you go down to Monticello in Virginia, Jefferson's place, you see that he got plants from the Prince Nursery, Flushing, Long Island.
And let's talk for a second, though, about Prince's Nursery during the Revolution, because the Battle of Brooklyn was occurring, and the First Continental organized American army was battling, and General Howe, the British general, actually kind of barricaded the nursery to protect it, because I would imagine the British really thought of the nursery property and the products on the plants as theirs. So they did not want any harm to come to this piece of property, because these plants were actually under British law.
And they were valued.
And they were valued, because this is what we were fighting for. This is the, you know, this is the American ethos, right?
Right, and I've heard this from Chuck, who heard it from Jack Eichenbaum also, who's the Queen's historian, is that the plants came first and the people followed.
Yeah.
Yes,
and
exactly.
You think about it, we all eat. This is what unifies us, even to this day.
Right.
And Queens is one of the most ethnically diverse places in the entire world, really.
Right.
And we see this every day. It's the food, and food comes from plants that unifies.
Right. So Jefferson, Madison, and Washington were big clients, customers of the Prince's Nursery.
And Adams came with them,
Adams,
too.
And Adams, exactly. Yeah. And Ben Franklin. And, you know, all the early kind of American horticulture masters. And, you know, it was these plants that really spawned the ideology of our Constitution and you know, our kind of theory about ourselves as a democracy.
And there's also, you're asking about plants. I've, in the last maybe 8-9 months, become friendly with Steve Castles.
Uh-huh.
He has a book that just came out, Grapes of the Hudson Valley.
Right.
And he talks about the early breeders. That's how his book is different.
Uh-huh.
And so that you can understand their work, because people were trying to solve different sorts of problems or issues as we do today.
Right.
And so he actually has some of the things. He writes about it, but he also grows grapes, and he has some of his grapes have Prince Nursery stock, if you will.
Yeah.
So it's very exciting. And Steve also says an interesting thing. He says, like people, there are no pure grapes. They're all hybrids.
Right.
And, you know, we're all hybrids. If you come down to it, we are.
Yeah.
In Flushing and Queens, this is what we're all about. This is what America is about. And this is the strength, because Chuck has a story about France and how the grapes were.
Well, over in Jefferson lived in France, and
uh-huh.
he appreciated the French cuisine and so on very much. And so he was interested in having grapes grown in America. Now, the Prince family, they were growing grapes and distributing grapes that were from Europe, the European wine grapes.
Mm-hmm.
So he had well over 50 to 100 varieties of that, but they also had the American grape, the Vitis vinifera. And they were not considered so great for wine, but we think of many of them as the Welch's grape juice kind of grape, which was from the Concord grape, but other varieties of grape too. But the thing about it is that the American grape saved the wine industry of Europe.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
And that was Prince's Nursery.
That was Prince's Nursery. Phylloxera was attacking the grapevines of Europe and killing all those wine grapes.
And that's a disease, by the way.
Right.
Yes.
Listeners.
Yeah. And so they were able to learn that the American Vitis vinifera was resistant to this disease.
Mm-hmm.
So they could graft the wine grapes of Europe onto the rootstock of the American grape, and it could grow in the European soils okay.
Right.
So we basically, Americans, and we've talked about this before, Americans saved the French wine industry, the European wine industry.
It literally did.
Yeah.
Yes.
And, you know, another Prince plant is the sugar maple trees. You want to talk a little bit about that? That was kind of Jefferson's ideology.
Thomas Jefferson knew the triangle that was going on in the slave trade, and then the sugar would be picked up and then would be brought over and traded for slave. It was awful, but it was being done.
It's history, right?
Jefferson was looking for an alternative to sugar supply because he said, we don't want to depend upon that supply of sugar. So he knew that the sugar maple in New England was wonderful, grew up into Canada, was wonderful. He had all of the available sugar maples, Acer saccharum. Mm-hmm. He had it brought down to Monticello, and he planted a whole grove of sugar maples down there.
Mm-hmm.
He took all the stock from Prince that he could get.
Uh-huh.
And so it's a little far south for the sugar maple.
Yeah, sure.
They didn't flourish there too well, but he, up to our lifetime, there was one or two of those maples still growing at Monticello.
Right, right.
But he wanted to see if this would be an alternative for the sugar supply.
Uh-huh, exactly. Yeah. And another thing that came through Prince's Nursery is the first propagation of the native pecan trees.
Wonderful.
You know, and I mean, Prince was really the epicenter of American hort as we know it today. And it's all New York, you know.
And I've heard Chuck say for years that Flushing is the birthplace of horticulture in America.
It is. It is.
It's true.
It is. So we know that the house is gone, mm-hmm. right, unfortunately. But tell us how the land became transformed into the QBG.
And we're not on the exact land, but when you were very nearby, like a stone's throw, if you have a good arm.
If you're one of the Mets.
my son could do it. But there's a Prince Street in Flushing, and it's very well known in the Chinese community in particular. But we're on property that's right near, and there was the Parsons Nursery, too, that came. There was a whole lot of growers in this area because, of course, it was away from the center. Uh-huh. And so Queens Botanical Garden came into existence after the 1939 World's Fair. Uh-huh. And there was a garden there. And World's Fairs are a lot about innovation. And so Jackson and Perkins Roses started their mail order business in a big way after that. And hydroponics was showcased, growing plants in water. And after the fair, a group of local people associated with the Long Island Press kept the garden going. And then in the 1940s, we legally came into existence and then were moved by Robert Moses again to make way for the 64 fair. Yeah. But anyway, I mean, I think the theme for me about World's Fairs and this whole area is about innovation. And that's something Prince was about. Now, another story that Steve told me from his book, and by the way, it is available at Flint Mine Press. And I highly recommend you look it up because it's got a lot of history in it. But is also that Prince was one of the first to start naming plants because at that time, and Carmen was telling us about her father and how he has this great vine and he just gives people cuttings all the time. She's going to give some to Chuck. But people would just sell their plants. And so to really sell plants farther, you needed a catalog, so you needed names.
Right.
And so Prince and others at that time were among the first. And what's very interesting, too, is this is the same time, 1737, is when Linnaeus, mm-hmm. who created what they call the binomial system of nomenclature, so Acer rubrum, red maple, two names that help you know, just like my name is Susan Lassert, but it's in reverse. And so they were the ones that were doing that. That's innovation.
Uh-huh.
You know, so we have a lot of innovation here in this part of the world.
Right, right. It's New York.
It's New York, yeah.
Some other things that have come out of Queens is it's a lot of fruits and native nuts and gooseberries and raspberries and strawberries. It's all the kind of subsistence things that one would need. But a lot of the Lewis and Clark plants came into commerce through Prince's. And Prince really was able to sell a bazillion things. His catalog was huge.
Yes, and we have some photos. I think the 1835 issue that Chuck brought with us, Alice and I are going to post it on our Facebook page so you can see pages of an actual catalog.
And these are figs from Italy.
Olives.
Olives.
I noticed that there were olives.
And this is all in Flushing in the late 1700s.
Well, another thing that Steve told me, too, is that the princes probably made a lot of money by people just going to look at all that they had.
Right.
And that they had greenhouses. And I thought, wow, because botanical gardens in this country didn't happen until the mid-1800s with Missouri Botanical Garden, the New York Botanical Garden a little later. And so here, it's like a precursor of the Queens Botanical Garden, really.
The Linnaean Society, right.
Well, isn't it interesting that they named their nursery the Linnaean Botanical Garden. But speaking of visitors, you know that George Washington came out there to see the Prince Nursery when he became president, was seated in New York City first.
Right.
And he came out to Flushing Landing with John Adams. And so they went and they toured the garden and so on. They also say Washington visited Long Island to thank his spies who were out there and so on. But he was very busy. He stopped by the garden and he said, well, I really found the plants there rather trifling.
Only a Virginia man can say that.
Because he thinks of the great growing that we have on the plantations of Virginia and so on. But this garden had suffered for 10 years of neglect.
It's true.
It's lucky it was still there.
Yeah.
I mean, it was to such an extent that the Prince family was, some people say that the cherry trees that they grew there were they couldn't sell them, so they sold them for barrel hoops,
yeah,
or the hoops around women's skirts. And so they had to think all the time, how are we going to survive?
Right.
But you know, they introduced the Lombardi poplar to
That's
America.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
And we think of it now as a tree that it doesn't live too well. But you know, I was at Bouchard Garden out in British Columbia this summer, past summer, and I saw the most magnificent Lombardy poplars that were absolutely huge. I said, oh, this is the way they're supposed to look.
Yeah.
And so I said, they experimented, they planted, as you say, olives and other exotic fruits, figs and so on like that. They were all here.
Uh-huh.
And they appreciated flavors and subtleties of food and fruits, as we hear about all the gourmets today. Oh, this apple is superior to that apple because it has such a wonderful flavor of roses and raspberries and so on.
Yeah.
But they knew it all.
I have to also mention, because this is how Carmen and I met, Mr. Prince, William Prince, was a founding member of the Horticultural Society of New York, which is where Carmen and I met.
And where I met you also, Alice.
Exactly. So it's really a full circle New York story of plants, right?
I wonder if Prince Street in Manhattan is also named after him.
Could possibly be.
Because if he was that prominent,
right?
You know, it's possible.
One other just odd fact that I found when I was doing the research. So Mr. Prince was friendly with a man named David Hossack, who established the Elgin Botanic Garden in 1801. Mm-hmm. And this was the city's original botanic garden, which was a series of conservatories and glass houses, which is where Rockefeller Center is today, in the middle of Manhattan.
Right today.
Yeah.
So how amazing was horticulture in early New York history, right?
Oh.
You can't ignore it.
You think about in the Victorian era how they built the Crystal Palace, and there was a Crystal Palace built in America, too.
Uh-huh.
These huge glass conservatories that would have all kinds of exotic trees and birds and all plant life and growing right there that people could walk into a
Pennsylvania Station.
Tropical.
Yeah. Right.
Pennsylvania Station was a glass enclosed, you know.
Conservatory-esque. Right. Yeah. There is actually plans to redesign that and get rid of that, or actually move it over into what is now the post office. Right, and put the trains in the post office and make a glass ceiling again, which would be
that would be very nice,
lovely. Yeah, but a majority of the plants at Monticello actually came from the Prince's nursery. So Jefferson was a big, huge patron of the nursery.
Yeah, and probably Madison had a great many plants brought over to his place, too.
Right.
Yeah,
right.
They were all impressed by the Prince Nursery.
Right.
It was the place to go.
Right.
And sometimes it's overshadowed by Bartram down at Philadelphia. And a lot of people in the south of New York, they think, Bartram was the one. But Prince was absolutely... That family, four generations.
Right, almost 150 years, right.
And they stemmed back to 1621, Plymouth Colony. The first governor in the Plymouth Colony was a prince, and they were related.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I didn't realize the lineage went that far back. Wow.
Yes.
Well, and next year, 2017, is the 280th anniversary of the establishment of the Prince Nursery, and I've been working with Richard Horhan at Queen's Historical, which is a great organization, and we're hoping to have some events at the garden, like maybe Steve Castle said he'd bring some of his grape-growing friends down, and he would do some talks, and we're going to celebrate, because you know, it's one of those geeky things, but I love history, I love plants, and you put it all together, what do you get? Prince Nursery.
Exactly. So. Well, we have to take a break. Hang on one second. You're listening to We Dig Plants on Heritage Radio Network.
We'll be right back.
favorite song is Third Degree Rug Burns by Taxstar. This is We Dig Plants. We'll be right back.
The International Culinary Center is a proud sponsor of the HeritageRadioNetwork.org. The ICC, with locations in New York and California, provide cutting-edge education to future chefs, restaurateurs, and wine professionals. We're proud to claim Dan Barber, Bobby Flay, and David Chang among our honored alumni. This is Dorothy Cann Hamilton from Chef Story. Check out our ICC website at internationalculinarycenter.com.
Hi, we're back. This is We Dig Plants, and we're talking about Prince's Nursery today, the first nursery in the United States. And we're talking with Susan Lesser and Chuck Wade from the Queen's Botanical Garden. And we just, before the break, we were talking about the property and the kind of segue from Prince's Nursery to Flushing and the QBG as kind of an epicenter for horticulture in America. Tell us a little bit, Susan, about QBG today and the diversity of the people and the garden attendance and all that great, fantastic stuff.
Yeah, I love this place. Our garden, Queen's Botanical Garden, we think of it as the place where people, plants, and cultures meet.
Yeah.
Where people, plants, and cultures meet. And there's so much because people, we all come from some heritage of growing plants or eating plants. And while sometimes newer immigrants don't want to do work with plants because it feels like life on the farm and it was hard and whatever, lately more people have come back to it and they want, there's the whole local movement and about understanding where your food comes from and growing it. And it's really a beautiful thing. So we do all sorts of programs at the garden, the children's garden. That's what Chuck hired me for years ago. I'm very thankful that Chuck hired me when I was new in my career. It's like, wow, I get paid to do this. Whoa. And but children's garden, I mean, you know, when you work with children when they're young and they take things home and they share it with their parents. But then a lot of times in Queens, you have people that don't, the parents or grandparents don't speak English. And so the children become the great translators. And so there's children's garden, there's programs for seniors, there's this Tai Chi every morning. Mm-hmm. Cliff Chin is the head of it. And every morning it's a traditional use of open space. So it's not just food plants, but it's other uses as well. And I think because Queens, Flushing is so densely populated, this really becomes an oasis for the whole community. And QBG is right in the center of Queens, so it's like the heart of the borough.
Right, because Queens is the most diverse of the New York City boroughs. Can you tell us a little bit about your population?
Yes. And of course, with the World's Fair, we were involved with a lot back then, and the borough president of Queens, Melinda Katz, now calls it the World's Borough.
Right. Yeah.
And it's really true. Our number one visitor group are Chinese Americans, about 32%. Mm-hmm. And that's from different parts. You know, there's Cantonese speakers, Mandarin, and other dialects. Then the number two group is Caucasians, about 28%, and about 21% are Hispanic Latino. But of course, that represents many people from many different places like Ecuador and Mexico and Puerto Rico and Argentina, all sorts of places. And then there are smaller populations, African American, Korean, mm-hmm. South Asian, and all of these have much diversity within them.
And the Queens Botanical Garden, I have to say, has one of the first green roofs
in the city.
In the city. And so the, you know, Prince's Nursery was cutting edge. Queens Botanical Garden is also cutting edge. It's one of the most beautiful green roofs. You can actually walk through it, through the meadow. Yeah. It's a great place. Every time I go, I have to walk across that roof because it's just gorgeous.
You know? It's about innovation. And,
yeah.
And also this garden long before my time, but this garden in the early 60s was put in this particular location, and it was a time of Rachel Carson and Silent Spring.
Yeah. Right.
And so there was a real emphasis on bee garden, bird garden, wetland garden, and these sort of things are so important to our lives. And I think that that's the innovation. World's Fairs are about that. But also our green roof, that we have a LEED Platinum building.
The first one.
The first public in New York.
Yeah.
And we don't have any oil or gas that's used in our building. None. Right. We have the first composting toilets in New York City in our building, which saves between that and the gray water system, which the water from the is cleaned. Water from showers and sinks is cleaned and then is used in other ways for flushing the toilets. Means that our building uses 82% less water than a conventional building, which is a lot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Every 100 gallons, we're not using 82. But then also the landscapes gather water. So that's about innovation, too. It's about doing things that others haven't done. And I think that's part of the role of cultural institutions. But it goes back to Prince, because he was doing things at that time that others were not doing.
Well, he was importing plants from all over the world.
Right.
And selling them. You know, New York is a commercial city. It's all about sales and market. You know, you can't ignore that. And diversity. I mean, Chuck Wade, you came here from the middle of the country, and you ended up running the QBG. You studied horticulture, right?
Yes.
I
studied at the University of Missouri.
Right.
And I got my master's from St. John's here in Queens.
So my
master's was in teaching science and education, secondary school.
And then you taught science to high school kids, botanical science.
I taught
science
at the Agricultural High School in Queens.
Right.
Which still
that
exists.
Was my second half of my career.
Right. Yeah.
John Bowne High School, Flushing, Queens, Main Street.
Yeah.
Yes.
Prince's Nursery.
I want to bring up one thing. It's Susan, you know, as you know, survival is very important for all organizations, especially not-for-profits. They have to think. And so when I was director, I had to think what we have to do that can tie in and bring money. Mm-hmm. And so I established the first wedding garden in America.
Yes.
I did not know that, Chuck.
At the Botanical Garden.
Wow.
Because we had to think of a way that we could make the garden, it could be a beautiful exhibit in the garden,
right,
a wedding garden,
right,
but it could also be used, and the people did come to have their wedding.
See, it's economics. It's plants and economics,
yes,
right? The driving force.
Yes, and I can't tell you how many people, I go around town and they have pictures. We're in a lot of photo albums.
Yeah.
All
over the world,
all
probably.
Over the world.
Yeah.
And
all
you know, the other gardens wouldn't accept that. They said, oh, no, we would not have such a thing in our garden.
Right.
And Brooklyn and New York and the others,
right,
they came.
Right.
Later.
Right.
Yes.
Yeah, at that time in botanical gardens, it was about the collections and about the education. It wasn't about performances and weddings and things like that. But
community, cultural.
It is, and it's become so important because I say to people, it's one of the most important days of your life. And you're celebrating it at a garden.
Right,
this
right.
This is powerful.
Right, exactly. And the thing is, I think in New York, because we're such a commercial city and we're all about the market and the economics, there is less and less space, which means less and less plants for people to digest and think and have awareness about their life and their world. And, you know,
And as the natural world is shrinking, these public places are
becoming
more and more important. For so many urban kids, that might be the only nature they ever see. Right,
right,
Susan?
Right.
I mean, that they may not ever get to a national park. They may not ever see any place truly wild.
Well, one of our council members, our wonderful council members, Danny Drum, he's from Jackson Heights. When I visited him a few years ago, he said it's really important, the field trips. He says just to get the kids out of the neighborhood so that they know that there's a bigger world out
exactly.
there.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Well, and Prince's Nursery did that. That's what they did.
Yes.
They imported plants from all over the world and sold them. You know?
Think about it. Before there were botanical gardens, there was the Linnaean Botanical Garden. The princes were ahead of these things.
They were princes.
So has anything been formally published about Prince? I mean, is at all a book or a pamphlet or anything?
There was some stuff that I found. There's a lot of referencing, but there's, as far as I know, Carmen, no.
There hasn't been like a formal history or a book. I think that it's time.
It's an opportunity.
Yeah.
Well, you know, you've got your anniversary coming up.
Yes,
and
we do.
QBG is really the front runner for
Susan,
this.
Susan, we could collaborate. We could do a book.
Yeah. And with Queens
Flushing.
Historical.
Yeah.
With Steve Castles, because Steve knows a lot.
Yeah.
Exactly. And, you know, I found some stuff at the Smithsonian. Mm-hmm. I found some stuff, you know, in the National Archives. And, you know, there's lots of referencing, and but mm-hmm. no, there's no like tome.
Yeah, and I came to New York. I realized that my parents were very surprised I ended up in New York City. They avoid it. They're traveling to Florida. They go around New York City. Uh-huh. But I realized that after I got here, that part of what attracts me to New York is the diversity. Mm-hmm. That's what attracts me to plants, is I love the stories of rubber and how peppercorns were used as currency and quinine helped cure malaria, uh-huh. and things like that. So we have all of that. And it is thanks to Prince.
Well, and the mulberry. And the mulberry and the silkworm. And,
oh, the silkworm.
Yeah. And that actually was Prince's nursery. That was probably the demise, was they invested too heavily in the mulberries.
Yeah.
In the late 1860s.
They had brought many mulberry plants here, but the white mulberry, and they imported from France the mulberry that would be principally used for the feeding of the silkworm.
Uh-huh.
But there is a great deal about that cocoonery in the history of Flushing.
Uh-huh.
And people didn't realize that. The Manchester, Connecticut. That's the town in Connecticut where the cocoonery or the silkworm industry uh-huh. became primary for a whole town.
That's a textile town, mm-hmm. so yes. that would yeah. make sense.
Yeah. And that was yeah. the one where the silkworm. I think the Cheney family were very okay. important in silk.
Yeah. Yeah. And this was, you know, this was speculation on behalf of Prince. And, you know, I think at that time, it's the end of the Civil War. And, you know, there was a lot of very strange funding, I'm sure. The landscape was very odd. As you just wrap up a war, it's probably not the time to be investing heavily in silkworm. But, you know.
Well, maybe they thought... They might have been thinking, who knows, the cotton industry has been kind of decimated.
Yes. Right,
maybe
exactly.
people will turn to silk
right.
as an yeah. alternative, and we won't need slaves
right.
to
right.
big plantations. It's a whole other business. So they took a leap.
They took a
perhaps.
Leap. Perhaps. Anyway.
But I think more research is needed.
Right.
I think
Absolutely.
If there's anybody out there in the ether who knows anything about this, reach out to us. We want
yeah.
to find out more.
Yeah. So we have one final question for our guests, which kind of goes back to our series that we're embarking on, that Carmen and I are embarking on. And the question is this, because you all are kicking off our American relationship and heritage horticulture and heritage, how do you think America and horticulture go together? Like, what's the relationship in a quick sentence or two, in your opinion?
Well, Chuck and I are each looking at each other. I think it changes. It swings with the time, but swings with the age.
Uh-huh.
But I think plants are so inspiring to people. You see plant imagery on fabric. You see it on wallpaper. You see it in motifs. And so it's really part of the fabric of who we are. You sometimes don't quite recognize that, but it's very important, and particularly when you live in cities, like in New York, there's that famous New Yorker cartoon of one tree out in front of somebody's house,
right.
spring, summer, winter, and fall.
Right.
And I think that epitomizes it, and thus that people love nature. It's a bonding place
uh-huh.
for people to be together, outdoor spaces, and I think that these places are really about democracy. Public gardens, which are full of plants, are about democracy and places for people to gather.
Free public space.
I do.
Available to all.
I believe it. I totally believe it.
Yeah.
It was like Olmsted and Vaux with Central Park. The idea
right.
was that there was a great mixing ground. And you see that in our garden at Queen's Botanical Garden
right.
all the time.
Right.
Because we do come from different backgrounds, but what we do is celebrate the commonalities and we celebrate the stories of plants. One time we had a program on cacao, the food of the gods.
Right.
And we got a cacao pod from JFK. They had confiscated it when it came through. And
it's good to have neighbors.
But they said we could borrow it. We just had to bring it back. And there was a man there with his daughter, and he was smiling from ear to ear because he grew up on a cacao plantation in the Philippines.
Right.
And he'd never been able to share this with his daughter.
Right.
So here we are in Flushing, where the airports are. I mean, the airports are the place. It's like the Ellis Island of modern day, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And we have all of this that started from the Prince Nursery and goes right to this day into the people you see at Queen's Botanical Garden, the place where people, plants, and cultures meet.
I go back to Thomas Jefferson. Thomas Jefferson and our forefathers of our country, our founding fathers, knew the importance of agriculture to build a great nation. A country is only as strong as its soil. It is the citizen farmer was and the educated farmer was primary in Jefferson's philosophy, that he wanted to make sure that our farmers were educated. They were not peasants. They were not people who to be looked down upon. They were the primary backbone of your country. And he saw that, and it's true. The land-grant colleges that followed with our dear Morrill and Mr. Lincoln and so on.
Right.
These things are in the thread of all things good in America. We love it.
Well,
that's a great way to
that
end.
That is the perfect ending.
Yeah. I have one more thing.
Yes.
Today is the new year.
Yes.
Yeah. Lunar New Year. It's the first time that students are getting off for this new year. It's very important.
Uh-huh.
And in Flushing is a wash in the color red. And it's the year of the monkey.
Yeah.
I was born in the year of the monkey.
Uh-huh.
I also have a birthday coming up once every 4 years on February 29th, by the way.
And you're wearing red.
Pays to advertise. But the custom I've learned from our finance director, other people locally, is that you give unmarried children red envelopes. You give them with money.
Uh-huh.
Now, the woman at the stand where I bought the envelopes this year said, you don't just give $1. That's unlucky. But give 2 or 5 or 10 or 20.
Oh.
And Alice and Carmine, you each have a child.
Yes.
So for you, I have each an envelope.
Oh.
You have to put in the money, however.
Okay.
Okay.
No problem.
Well, I will say that. Happy New Year. Gong Foy Hat Choy.
Thank you. Well, let me say, you have planted the seed for lots of future gardeners.
Yes.
With this $5 that I'm going to put in here. I think I'll buy my son a pack of seeds.
Yes.
And,
that's a great thing to
continue on. And thank you for all of your good work at QBG. And thank you for coming and sharing with us the history and for kicking off our series.
Heritage and Horticulture.
And be sure to plant a tree to commemorate a birth, a death, anything in the family that needs to be commemorated. Plant a tree.
Yeah.
It'll always be there.
Yeah.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
So thank you for listening to Weeding Plants on the Heritage Radio Network. The show was produced by Allison Carmen, your fearless hosts. thank you to our sponsor. If you miss any part of the show, please note it's available via archive on the website, heritageradionetwork.org, and via podcast on iTunes and Stitcher. Please leave comments and reviews on our Facebook page, Groundworks Inc. We Dig Plants, also on Instagram, Groundworks Gardens NYC, and on Twitter, at We Dig Plants. Happy gardening.
Thanks for listening.
See you in the garden.
Listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archive programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.
Hey everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.